Welcome everyone to this interview, where I'm super excited to be talking with a friend of mine, Anthony Ambagnano. And we're going to be exploring the role of the breath in supporting integrating the fragmented parts of ourselves. One of the big impacts of trauma is that we end up fragmenting and splitting off, and bringing ourselves back to wholeness is really the heart of what a lot of trauma healing is about. To give you a little bit of Anthony's background, Anthony Ambagnano is a visionary thought leader, breath expert, and founder of the internationally accredited breathwork school, Alchemy of Breath, which is a 100,000 person online community dedicated to evolving collective consciousness. He currently lives in Italy, where he co-founded Alchemy School of Healing Arts with his wife, Amy. Asher supports breathwork, holistic practices, sustainability, growing food, and building community. So firstly, Anthony, welcome. I'm really pleased to have some time together.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Well, I think a good place to start this conversation is just to open up the relationship between trauma and fragmentation in ourselves. Like, how do the traumas that we're impacted by, how do they cause us to be more separate and more fragmented?
That's a great question. I work with the breath, so I'm going to use this as my way of explaining it. But really, every time that we were traumatized as children, we lost our breath. And that still happens today. And in that moment that we lose the breath, we're losing our processing power as well. We go into that flight, fight or freeze, and our frontal lobe stops working. But I think the fact that we lose our breath is really what then embeds the trauma in the body, and something gets frozen in our development as a human being. And my experience has told me that that is actually a part of ourselves. Because we use a 2 or a 5 or a 7 year old coping system, and we seek to sort of keep calm and carry on as best as we can as human beings. But actually, that usually means covering something up and not revisiting it. So then we continue through life, and the more abstract that part of us can become, actually, the more comfort we feel, because we're not having to revisit anything painful.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's almost like the defensive mechanism which kind of kicks in and works continues to work on one level, but also we're paying a big price on another level.
Exactly. It is doing the best it can in that moment. And of course, that price that we pay extends to using that same operating system that we developed in the crunch moment as a 3-year-old when we're adults. So it becomes dysfunctional, and we can't really, I mean, if you imagine this happening a series of times, like thousands of times, that every time we're hurt or wounded, we have that moment of fear or terror or embarrassment or shyness or shame or any of those emotions. And that part is a part of us that we don't want to have to feel again. So we kind of archive it away, but it does go into the body archive and it doesn't go away.
And do you want to say a few words about some of the ways that that shows up then in life as an adult? So we have these defender places, we have these kind of fragmented places where we're split off from some of those impacts and experiences. How does that then show up, or what's the price that we pay for that in day-to-day life?
Yeah, I think the second part of that question is more relevant, because that's actually the part that doesn't show up, is the fragmented part. So what shows up is what's left. So if you can imagine going through a lifetime of a series of incidents that fragmented our self, who we are, and they got left behind, what's left is what shows up. And that's not really all of who we are. It's a part of who we are that's learned how to navigate under duress and under stress. And it's not well equipped, because the operating system is often decades old. So there needs to be something to happen to change that. And how we see that play out in the world today is evident when we look at our prime ministers and presidents. You know, essentially, we're all traumatized human beings. And unless we take the time to create relationship with those parts of us that were fragmented and chipped off the block, then we're going to be reactive, argumentative, escalatory. We're not going to really help each other to a peaceful existence.
It's also, I guess, the case that it takes a lot of psycho-emotional, I guess also physical energy in a sense, to maintain all of that fragmentation and separation, right? Like to keep those parts of us away is not an effortless practice.
No, it's not. And it's an effortful investment in a dysfunctional practice. So I believe that the medical world will increasingly become aware of the fact that these psychological traumas are in the body somewhere, and they are connected to chronic and fatal diseases, because we live with that unease or that dis-ease for so long, and we keep pretending it's not there and covering it up. So it ends up being a place of eventually chronic pain or chronic difficulty. And then I believe that can lead to obvious physical consequences.
I guess it's also tricky in a sense that we normalize, right? Like the way that it is with those parts of us split off and separated, we get so familiar with the way that we experience ourselves and the way that we experience our relationships in the world that it's not that we're aware day to day that that's what's happened. And that becomes part of the challenge, right? That it's not in our attention because we've just normalized to that being the way that it is.
That's so true. And that normal is not natural. And we've lost the distinction between normal and natural. We think it's normal to be a part of who we are, and we can grab a persona here or there, a way of behaving, a way of coping, a way of presenting ourselves to a quite a brutal and hard-edged world. And gosh, we go to bed exhausted at the end of the day, and then we wake up the next morning and we do it all over again. You know, we keep on investing in the perpetuation of actually not being fully who we are. And if we're going to go into the world with diminished awareness, then surely we're going to achieve diminished outcomes. Well, and when you think of people interacting too, that, you know, what, for example, if I insult you or hurt you in some way, it's usually your inner child, that person that you used to be, that is getting wounded. And then you'll answer back to me because you're wounded and you'll hit my wound. In fact, you're trying to hit my wound. So, and that's what we do as human beings. We keep on triggering each other without taking the time or the breath to actually restore, to actually reintegrate those fragmented parts. So you could say each trigger we have is an opportunity to do some reflection and to retrieve that part of us that is activated. So it's not left alone in our body archive or in our psychic history somewhere, that we can actually go back there and retrieve it.
It's also, I guess, important to say that it's not that we fragment these parts and then they're just gone. That as you've been saying, they're still impacted and we're still reacting from those places. They're actually having significant consequences in our lives. It's just because we're not in touch with them, we're not able to work with it.
Yeah, just like Bruce Lipton said, only 4 or 5% of the choices we make come from our conscious processing mind. And that means 95-odd% are coming from the subconscious mind. So those programs we wrote then, that little inner child or that fragmented part of who we once were, is the one that rules the show if we get activated. That's why it's so damaging.
Let's then bring in the breath. And obviously a big part of your work as a breathwork teacher is using the breath to support healing. But maybe before we come into specifically how the breath relates to this aspect, maybe just say a few words around why breath is so important and why it's at the heart of so much of our lives.
Yeah, thank you. It's amazing what is actually under our nose and what we manage to avoid paying attention to. And of course, the only time we really pay attention to our breath, unless we create a practice of intimacy with it, is that is when we lose it. That's when we realize that we need more and we don't have enough, and it's threatening and frightening. I think the breath is significant here in the retrieval of these fragments or the defragmentation, because essentially we have the chance to take the breath back to that part of us that got left behind and lost his or her breath in that moment. That sounds a little bit abstract, because, well, what does that mean? You take it back to who you once were. It all sounds a bit woo-woo or ethereal. But actually, there are ways, and there's a practice that I've developed called The Bridge, which is an acronym, which is a little sort of 30-minute process that we use to help a client locate that fragment using the body. It's an embodiment practice, and retrieving it with a dialogue and then helping it back into integrity again. And that's what I've found over the last 10 or 12 years to have been the most effective way of retrieving these fragments. It's a little bit similar to Richard Schwartz's work, Internal Family Systems, but it's perhaps more direct and more straightforward.
You say Bridge is an acronym. Can you just walk us through, just very obviously, it's a bigger process than we're going to get into today, but just what those some of those key pieces are?
Yeah, for sure. Well, the B is for breath, right? So if you were my client, I'd ask you, are you willing to use the breath as your tool as we go into this journey? And so that's the first thing to establish, that the client is willing to use the breath. And we need to remember that willing means that we're going to use our will. You know, there are times when I'm going to remind you that you're going to need to breathe and you're going to come back to your breath, because that's really your lifeline. And that's actually what you're taking back to that point in your life when you got wounded. And then the next thing to do is the R, which is to recognize. And that's really recognizing that this part is separate from who you are. And that's quite a hurdle for a lot of people, because if I feel incredibly overwhelmed, I don't have the emotional awareness that it's just a part of me that's overwhelmed. So in a conversation with someone, and I've noticed, and you do this in some of your, I saw one of your YouTubes where you were interviewing a client, and the way that you work is so beautiful. And the way that we work with the bridge is to, if someone does have a sense of, I can't cope, or I want to die, or it's all too much, one of the primary questions I'm interested in is, who is feeling that? You know, what part of you is feeling that? And if the client is able to recognize that, then everything has a different perspective. It's like, oh, okay. I think Dan Siegel said, if you don't realize that you're separate, you can't bring yourself back together again. And so that recognition is recognizing that we're broken as human beings, and those fragments are lying inside us somewhere, but they're separate from who we are. So that's the second stage. Then the I is really for investigating and inquiring. And that means inquiring into the body sensation you feel now with your conscious mind today, when you reflect on who you once were and the wound that you once received. So it's not really about the instrument of the trauma. It's about the impact or the imprint that it left. And I think this perhaps differs from other trauma work, because we're not trying to release the trauma. We're actually trying to go behind it and retrieve that little one that was wounded and bring them back into wholeness again. The D for bridge is then dialogue. And that's where a conversation occurs between you and this perceived being that you once were. And then the G is for gathering. And that means really just taking a few moments with the breath, just to consciously imagine, bring the image of this integration happening. So you can really feel like this part of you can be welcome now. And the dialogue that happens before is also another major threshold in the process. And so the gathering then is just almost one of relief. This is often when tears come and people are just overjoyed at this sense of union that they feel. And then the E is for exercise. And that's that I added on later because when I made the acronym, because I discovered that people kept coming back to me a week later and they'd say, hey, I need to do it again. Something else happened and I'm a bit disturbed. Can you help me do it again? And so I wanted to devise a way that they weren't dependent on me, but they could be empowered to do it themselves. And so I introduced the exercise, which is a very simple practice that every day or twice a week that you could put into place. You're probably doing it casually anyway, but something so simple as putting a photograph of who you were at that age on your bathroom mirror or on your Facebook page, or take the first three breaths of every day and welcome any connected feelings you can experience with who you once were as a child. Or every time you eat ice cream, that you'll take that first three licks for the little boy or the little girl inside, you know, to make it playful and fun. People do dancing, they do all kinds of, they have all kinds of ideas that they can use. And that really helps them afterwards to embody this new awareness and this new sense of integrity. Because of course, integrity is wholeness. So with each block we can bring back, then the more whole and more present we can actually be.
I'm a big fan of models and frameworks. I really like that, actually. I think it's a really clear way of mapping that journey. Let's talk a bit more about how we bring the breath into this. And so, just to kind of amplify something that you said, that in a sense, these fragmented places are places of us where our breath is not reaching. And I really like what you said, that it's not necessarily about releasing the emotion there. It's bringing that younger us back from that kind of isolated or frozen place. So say a little bit about how the breath helps us to do that.
Well, the first stage, or the second stage, when we go into the recognition and the investigation of the bridge, is usually quite emotional. And if it wasn't emotional, if someone was sort of heady and they couldn't access their feelings that easily, which is often a protection, right? Because they're used to a whole lifetime of finding ways not to feel. So that's really a key moment where I would use something like a conscious connected breath, which would help people unblock the emotions, because that's one of its primary functions. And if you breathe through the mouth and you breathe a connected breath, and if you open the back of your throat as you breathe a connected breath, that really encourages a sense of vulnerability and emotional presence. So I would work with that during that sort of secondary and tertiary stage of the process, just to build the emotional presence to a degree that's sufficient. I don't need people to go into catharsis or go into the drama. It's really not about the drama. It's about maintaining that distinction that the client is actually the rescuer here. They're moving into the parent role for themselves. This is the moment where they're really reclaiming their ability to respond to a situation that they couldn't respond to properly earlier on in their lives. So the breath is useful to stimulate the emotions when necessary. It's also useful to calm the emotions when necessary. So if I find they're getting too emotional, I would immediately say, okay, let's come back to that breath again, because when we get emotional, we stop breathing, right? So I say, okay, let's breathe through the nose for a few breaths, and we're going to take some gentle breaths and just soothing breaths, and know that each breath you're actually delivering to a part of yourself that has been waiting for it for ages. This is so significant. You don't have to think about it. Just do it. Just allow the breath to come and then bring them back into presence with what they're doing. And then those are the critical times where the breath can be used, but you can use different breaths as you go through the process.
I want to explore a bit more this point around the difference between getting pulled into the emotion of the experience and this piece that I think is really interesting around using the breath to actually stay present here. It's almost like, to use your word, like a bridging of two worlds, right? But it's not a just disappearing into the history. It's staying rooted in the resources we have now but meeting that younger place from there.
Yeah, exactly. I think an analogy that works for me when I describe this with a client is that you could think, for example, of those kids in Thailand that were stuck in a cave and all the time it took to get a tube in there to get them air. That's essentially what you're doing. You're clearly, and this is because I asked you if you're willing to go through this process in the beginning, and this is clearly where your will is necessary. You've got to muscle up to the fact that you are going back there to do this work, and it's serious work. It might only take half an hour, but it's intense. People come out the other side of the experience completely different. That will is the key. That question, are you willing, is really the kind of almost a trick question, because I'm willing to do it. And then they don't realize that means that, oh gosh, I'm really going to have to do this. So
yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think about some of the moments in my own therapeutic work over the years. And sometimes we have those moments where really we have that choice, that we sort of stay as we are and stay in a kind of familiar place, but a place that's got a lot of suffering. But we also recognize that if we want it to be different, we have to do something else that's almost more scary in that moment. And I'm curious as to, as you've sat with people in those moments, what you find helps them take that leap. Like, is it just grace? Is it just timing? Is it there's a certain amount of just frustration with how things are? What do you find helps people take that step?
I love that question. I think, you know, in my generation, and we had things like midlife crises. And I remember in a group a couple of weeks ago, I was doing an inner child workshop, and we had 600 or 700 people there. And I said, what would you consider to have been a rite of passage in your life? And 95% of the answers were disasters: the death of a parent, divorce, the loss of my son. Only 5% were things like the birth of my child, becoming a mother. But everything else was an impact that was externally driven and was hurtful. It was really, really tough. So I think the question is, how can we introduce these rites of passage, or reintroduce them, because we've lost them in our culture, in such a way as we can be ready to have the will to do this work that we need to do to enjoy life and to understand that, yes, suffering is here. Suffering is a part of life. And so is it our ability to negotiate with that suffering and not to wallow in that suffering. And so I encourage people to kind of become the detective of their suffering. You know, let's work on this together. Let's ask some questions together about this and encourage them to take the role of the rescuer. And that's empowering when people connect to that, like, oh God, there's actually something I can do. Okay. Because the choice was taken away that many years ago. And isn't it curious how when that choice is taken away, that's when we start to look to the outer world, either to blame or to solve. So we take pills or we point fingers, it's governments, parents, brother, whatever it might be, or work, whatever it is. But we really are unconsciously abdicating. We live a life of abdication from the possibility to get in the front seat, to grab the wheel. And we're sitting in the back of the car getting rattled around, you know, like an Indian taxi. And whereas we could actually jump in the front and grab the wheel and be more causative and more co-creative with life. So I think it's that for me, my work now is about something I call the journey to mastery, which is really about recreating those rites of passage so we can be prepared for them.
But that, I think that's one of the hard things, isn't it? But often, I think earlier on in a trauma healing journey, we become very aware of the things that happened to us. And particularly when we were younger, there was little they really did happen to us. And so we were a victim of those experiences. But then I think the challenge becomes that we can be in danger of becoming identified with being that victim, which is like a place, it's a sort of safe place that protects us, but it's also then a place that keeps us trapped.
Oh, gosh, yes. And you know what they say, that the victim hurts and hurts and hurts. And so other people in the field around them will also get damaged by I would say, almost addiction to the victimhood. And this is not, please, this is not to discount the impact of, you know, losing my child or being hit by a bus or something awful, being abused or raped or any of these things. There is a true victimhood. But the key, I think, to living a fruitful life is negotiating with that victimhood. It doesn't have to be me. It can be something that I can almost converse with. There's a conversation that can happen because a part of me stays the victim and can't climb out of it. And that loss of choice in that impactful moment of trauma, we have to use the power of our conscious mind to try reclaim that choice.
Yes, yes. I want to come a bit more back to the breath and perhaps come to some more practical ways of working with this. And so you mentioned about, for example, it's not necessarily using the breath to go into catharsis, although that may have its place at times. It's more about using the breath to really stay present. And so maybe you said a bit more about that and also why that presence is so important.
Well, I posit that if we give our attention to our breath, we are being present. I think it's impossible not to be present if we're giving our attention to our breath. So perhaps a little experiment might be worthwhile trying, which would take maybe 3 or 4 minutes, where we can actually put something like that into practice and we can experience it for ourselves. This is also an embodiment practice that we use a lot of, and the foundation of alchemy meditation is the same process we're going to go through. So let's take a big breath just to get rid of all the thoughts or feelings or anything. Just come into this place with one big breath. And then perhaps you can close your eyes and allow the breath to come normally through the nose, whatever is comfortable for you, and notice it. Just notice the breath. And notice how you can actually use it. For example, the out-breath to relax a little bit more. See if there's a point of tension anywhere in the body. Maybe the shoulders, the neck, the back. And the next time you breathe out, see if you can just soften a little bit. And let the thoughts come, let them go, just let them flow. That's no problem at all. Just come back to the breath every time you remember. Come back to bringing your awareness to your breath. And it's not how many times you forget you're breathing, it's how many times you remember that counts. And as your nervous system begins to settle a little bit, I'm going to ask you to think of perhaps a memory of the most joyful moment you ever had. Could be maybe it was your first kiss, or maybe it was being cuddled by your mum or your dad, or it doesn't have to be when you were a child. It could have even happened last week. As you're breathing, stay with your breath and indulge a little bit in that memory. see if you can notice something about the setting of that memory, or the sounds, or the tastes, or smells. Sort of get a little closer with each breath. And as you visit this memory, and as you breathe, give some attention now to your body and notice if there's any place in your body where this feeling actually lives. It might be your belly, or it might be your heart. Be any part of your body at all. And now, as you breathe, I'm going to ask you to see if you can use each breath to increase your attention on this part of your body. You may want to put a hand there to help. I'm going to take two or three breaths in silence now, just so you can see what you can do to strengthen your connection with this part of your body. And know that each conscious breath you're bringing to this part of your body is deeply, deeply nourishing and healing. And in this place, in this particular part of your body, is not just the memory of something pleasurable and joyful, but also is the part of you that experienced that for the very first time. That's where your joy belongs, in your body. So even if you're reflecting on something that happened a year ago or last week, it becomes a doorway to make a journey inside and to discover a part of you that first had that experience of joy. So let's take another two or three breaths just in silence, and whatever you can't experience, see if you can imagine it. And now, before we come back to opening our eyes again, just take another breath or two to say thank you to this body that has brought you here today. And thank you for this reminder of where my joy lives in my body. And so we'll just take a couple of breaths now to allow your attention to return to the room around you and explore opening your eyelids again in your own time. All in your own time. So what we did there was we did something with a positive memory. When we work with the bridge, we work with the memory that's less pleasant. But it's that ability that we cultivate as we practice, that ability to locate that sensation. So if it was a trauma, where do you feel it when you connect with it and who you once were? Where is it you feel it in your body now? And that then becomes the doorway through which we do our work. It's kind of like a portal.
Thank you, Anthony. I very much enjoyed that. a very pleasant memory of my dog snuggling on my face in bed in the morning. I think one of the things that is really helpful to see in it is that so much is there in our experience that's not necessarily in our conscious awareness. And part of the power and what you are guiding is our capacity to deliberately direct our focus, in a sense, and that there's so much, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier about the Bruce Lipson quote, that we're only using 5% of ourselves to make decisions, that we're also only accessing small parts of our capacity. And what it had me thinking is what our potential is when we start to reconnect these parts of ourselves, that as we become more integrated and more whole, what the ultimate kind of value of that is.
Yeah, I think it's almost immeasurable. I mean, the thing that fascinates me is when I think Bruce Lipton also says that 20% of the data is going that way and 80% is going that way. So the more we use our body in these experiences, the more intelligent we can actually become. And I think that the more sensitive we become to our own, what I call body archive, this archive of every experience cellularly stored in our body, the more familiar we become with it, the more we understand some really fundamental things, like vulnerability doesn't mean weakness. We can be vulnerable and we can be strong and present at the same time. And I think more than anything else, it helps us develop compassion for who we are as human beings. You know, we didn't mean to hurt other people. Nobody really wants to hurt other people. They say that under each heinous act is underneath at the bottom, is still a good intention, which is a difficult thing to accept, but it's tempting to believe that. And I think that what happens as a result of this self-compassion means that you can come up to me with a knife in your hand, and I'm going to be thinking, oh my gosh, you must really be suffering. You know, I had a friend who was robbed last week, and he came out of the experience. He lost money and other things from his house, and he came out in compassion for his perpetrator because he's in a state of presence enough that he can understand that it's part of our human condition. And if our true aspiration is to receive unconditional love and to give unconditional love, then surely we have to learn to love ourselves in all our conditions.
And of course, ultimately, a key piece of that is showing up and doing the work, right? And having the courage and having the will, to use the word that you used earlier, to go to these sometimes quite scary and challenging places. Because by doing that work, ultimately, we're bringing more of ourselves into the world.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to get more back too. It feels like a win-win to me.
Yeah. Do you want to say a few words for people of where they can start? We'll come in a minute to how people can find out more about you and your work and programs and so on. But just to people that have watched this interview that would like to go, well, what can I do with this now? What would be a couple of signposts of starting perspectives or pieces for them?
Well, I would recommend contemplating the concept of having an inner child, first of all, which might be very new to some people, but is basically the work that we're talking about. And so that might mean just noticing when you feel joy, or you have that raw belly laugh, or you're tickled pink for some reason or another, that's an emotion that began a long time ago and you're revisiting it. And so to notice it in pleasant ways and joyful and playful ways. If you have children, you know, there are perfect teachers. That directness and that rawness that they offer us is such a teaching for us adults, because they haven't really forgotten, you know, the essence of who they are, and they haven't had to cover up quite so much as we have. So that's another practice. And I think also generally, you know, breath work is such a buzzword these days, and it's all about huffing and puffing and getting high and, you know, changing your mind and all of these things. Really, the opportunity here is to become more aware of our breath. It's breath awareness. And there's an intimacy that's available with the breath in any condition. So if you are feeling pain in your body, if you're feeling stress, if you're feeling depressed, notice how you're breathing. Notice and start to catalog in your mind four or five different breaths that you go to, which are your go-to breaths. And know that there are ways to adjust those emotional and psychic conditions by adjusting your breath. You can actually reverse manipulate conditions just by using your breath. So you can deal with things like anxiety, like we talked a few months ago. You can depression, over excitement, and to sort of manic excitement. All of these, all nervousness, tiredness, all of these things can be really corrected by using the right breath.
Fantastic. Anthony, if people that want to find out more about you and your work, what's the best place to go and what's some of what they can find?
Well, alchemyofbreath.com. Alchemyofbreath.com is our main website. And if you go there, you'll be invited with a pop-up to join our Sunday Breathes, which is where our trainers, teacher trainers, do breath works every Sunday in the morning and the evening, English time. I do them once a month myself. As well. So you can check into that. It's free. And it's a great opportunity to practice breath work and to develop a, more of a strong relationship with it. And of course, we have all kinds of other things on there as well. And I'd love to, if people want to write to us, I'd love to give them a little booklet that is has got 37 different breath styles that you might want to experiment with, from going to sleep, waking up, making love, all kinds of different breath styles you can practice with. So I'd be happy to share that.
Beautiful. Anthony, thank you so much. I really appreciate your sharing and I look forward to our next conversation.
It's been a pleasure as usual. It's great to be with you.